everybody. I'm Scott, and welcome to Single Sitting. Again, we have with us here Mark, my partner on Single Sitting. How are you doing, Mark?
Fine so far. Living in a risk area in Germany, bound to my place right now. But after surviving COVID, and I want to tell you and your fans, mate, don't get it into you. It's horrible. It's okay. No fun.
I had a mild,
what's it called, fell off, a mild version of it. And even then, I can only recommend wear a mask.
Wear a mask. That sounds good.
Yeah. Jack Vance today.
Jack Vance, yes. Today. The Last Castle is what we're talking about. The Last Castle, a novella that was published in 1966 in Galaxy magazine. It won both the Nebula and a Hugo Award for Best Novella. Actually, for some reason, the Hugo Award was Best Novelette, but this is about 100 pages long in my paperback, which I read it in an Ace Double. Really nice edition. Has some cover art that doesn't make any sense, and I'll put that in the post. But I don't quite see how that has anything to do with what we're talking about. But it is a nice piece of art nonetheless. But yeah, so how to describe this story?
It's about a civilization in decline. And my first thought, I haven't read it for 10 or 15 years, I said, wow. He was really prescient on some aspects. And I'm not quite sure whether he knew about it. I'll come to that a little later. You can read it as a fable or as an allegory to the American history of slavery.
Yeah, yeah.
You can also read it as an echo of H.G. Wells' Time Traveler.
Time Machine.
And you can see it as the economy started to tumble a little bit, the society started to tumble a little bit in the, let's call it, for lack of a better word, Western civilization.
Mm-hmm.
Some unsolved, some too long ignored problems came up. And I think the story echoes that in a variation of ways. And we're going to talk about that one.
Agreed. So he's working in the far future, which is Jack Vance's normal thing. So far away that, you know, whatever's going on right now is distant memory, sometimes mythology.
Yeah, that's a wonderful aspect of that. We come to that a little later. I think we have to say that there must be another human civilization in space, because our protagonists that live in those castles, of which Castle Hagedorn is the last one, have come back from Altair, where nowadays, talking about the time of the story, seems to be the core civilization of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And these persons have come back to Earth a few hundred years ago, to the planet of their ancestors, and have erected 9 castles in which they live a life that could be thought of as being decadent, of being technological advanced.
Aristocrats,
idle rich.
No real connection with what's keeping them alive whatsoever.
Absolutely
and they've
not.
Got, they've basically enslaved people. The Mechs, you know, well, an alien race called the Mechs.
It's one of the races they've enslaved.
Yeah, they just consider them a lower class being.
Yep.
And basically, you know, they're like, well, they like to do this. So they're taking care of us. They're the only ones that know how to fix things.
Yeah, they've got 2 other races for transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And they have another race, one for entertainment, one they call, what was it called?
So the Fanes were the ones that were kind of entertainment. You've got birds that are flying creatures. You've got power wagons, which are like rectangular creatures that they're actually alive. You know, these are biological things that are just workers. And then you have peasants. And they've got limited intellectual capability, and they also work as servants. And then you have the Mechs, and the Mechs I always looked at as they were like people. I mean, they were like, you know, they weren't as alien as the other ones. And I don't know if that meant that they were men. Did you kind of get the feeling that they were men?
Sort of.
Yeah, me too. So. But
they're
the
human
ones
in that sense. They come from a different planet, and they are the, I think, the most human-like in the aspect of their outer appearance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then what occurs is the Max rebel.
And, the Max rebel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're the ones with all the knowledge because they're the ones who know how to fix the castles when something breaks. And they've got all the knowledge they need to take down any castle very easily, because the aristocrats on the other side have forgotten these things, and it is no longer even important to them. It doesn't even occur to them that it's important until these things happen.
I would go a little farther than that. Mm-hmm. It's not only that they have forgotten it. They ignore it completely because it's below their attitudes, below their dignity.
Yes.
We have lots of scenes in which some people who at least have theoretical knowledge of technique say, well, I will not use a tool. I'm a mm-hmm. gentleman, which is something else entirely. They do not live like people strolling through technical instruments they are unable to cope with. They do not want it at all. They don't want to learn it,
mm-hmm.
even if it were possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And we should add that these castle dwellers are not the only humans on planet Earth. There are this large group called nomads.
Mm, that's right.
That live like their ancestors and have got nothing to do with the castle dwellers. Mm. And there is a group with a rather strange name, expatriates. Mm-hmm. Is that correctly pronounced?
Yeah, yeah, expatriates. Yep. Yeah, it's expiationists.
Expiationists, sorry.
That's
expiationists.
Right, yeah. I had to look it up, too. Mm-hmm.
So had I. And it's people, I think, expiationists who do a certain atonement because in the core of their mind they know that living from slaves is wrong. And their reaction is to get away from the castles, get away from the luxury, and live a life, mm-hmm. we could call an Amish life.
Yeah,
if sure. you take a religious thing yep. into it.
Right.
It's the mm-hmm. Amish.
Yep, yep. Which, they have to work. They do work to sustain themselves, yep.
And changing fruits and polished wood toys against medication, for example. Mm-hmm. And this sounded a lot like the Amish people.
Yeah, yeah, very much.
At least to my European ear, I said, oh, that's interesting. So Vance is taking that up, that people distance themselves from the peak of civilization, whatever that peak may be, and say that's not the way to live. It's on the bones of other people.
Mm.
In this case, a Max. We have one protagonist. We might talk about that one rather later because an interesting figure with a rather strange name that's struck a chord with me.
You're talking about Xanten?
Xanten, as we would say in Germany, is a town in our vicinity here.
Really? I didn't know that. So how do
we
you connect that with...
have some strange names in the story. Yeah. It's, interestingly enough, it's one of the best kept archaeological sites of the Roman times here in Germany. It's a huge area with still rather proper ruins of Roman walls and murals and buildings, etc.
Hmm. Fascinating. So, mm-hmm.
If ever you come to Germany, it's a wonderful site, and you can spend a whole day in Xanten. Oh, and nice. I was always rather fascinated because it's to start a word with X is in Germany very, very unusual. Xanten is a rather strange name for German,
mm-hmm.
and of course it's heritage from the Romans, and I thought it's an interesting name if you talk of decadence and decline of civilization to give a protagonist this name. I cannot imagine
yeah.
that this is a coincidence.
Yeah, you can't. I can't imagine either. Yeah,
just like Hagedorn,
mm-hmm.
which is the name of the last castle. Hagedorn is Hawthorn.
Hawthorn?
Hawthorn. Mm? And some names I could not decipher, but Vance is playing here a trick on us.
Yeah.
So,
right. Ozzy, Gar, Klanghorn, Klanghorn,
yeah.
Philidor,
yeah.
And Glyze Meadowsweet.
yeah. Yep. Sounds like someone escaped from an Irish novel. yeah. Ozzy, Gar, I have been knocking out my brain. I seem to remember a name of a rather important person of the Confederate States of America with a name that is constructed the same way, but I cannot put my finger on it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So he was the traditionalist. He was the one who was like, yeah, this is what we want to do is keep the status quo. We like this. Yeah. And Zantin, you know, he is coming from the decadent society, but he's a person who seems to want to know what's going on and is learning from it.
Yeah. He's the only one with a significant change in character.
Right, right.
We have more or less cardboard characters. There are only two persons who really change. That is Xanten, of course, and to a lesser degree, the Hagedorn himself, the elected leader of the castle, who has at least not a complete change of mind, but who can cope with the new times in his own, although a conservative way, become the curator of the museum the castle turns into.
Mm-hmm.
And here, I think Vance is doing some interesting stuff politically and culturally. He sees the decadence of the castle, and still he allows a certain sense of nostalgia, at least for Hagedorn himself, who becomes a creative museum and says, oh, we still have some essences, and would you like to see the castle in the end when Xanten and his wife visit the castle again?
Yeah, and that's a really interesting thing. Another very interesting piece of this is they end up sending all the mechs back to their native planet.
Sure. Think of Liberia. Or the Back to Africa movement.
Kind of like that, yeah. So he sends them back there, and then they end up living, I guess, like the expiationists. Castle, and then the castle Hagedorn becomes a museum.
That's the idea.
Yeah.
It might seem a little rushed, the ending. Maybe that is something we have to check again, because the story starts on a much larger scale, I think, and maybe it exploded under his hands.
Maybe so. But yeah, it's like the very first line in it, Vance just contains so much in a sentence. He says here, you know, toward the end of a stormy summer afternoon, with the sun finally breaking out under ragged black rain clouds, Castle Janiel was overwhelmed and its population destroyed. In a sentence, you know. He's one that I feel is hard to read quickly. You kind of need to slow down with him. I find that in all of his writings, but it's always rewarding.
Yeah. And he's always trying with a sort of legerdemain. What's it called? No, what's it called in English? Sleight of hand. He's telling us about the Hagedorn and the guys who hang around there, the aristocrats. And in the end, he names someone. And B.F. Wyers, an equally sagacious antiquarian, who had identified the sites of many ancient cities. Palmyra, Lübeck, Eridu, Zanesville, Burton-on-Trent, and Massilia, among others. And I died laughing. For several reasons. Because Vance is doing this interesting trick here. Either these towns have become much more important in later times than ours. I know a few of them. Lübeck, for example, is a beautiful town, but of absolutely no importance, except that there's a Thomas Mann house, and they make wonderful marzipan. And I think Burton-on-Trent or Zanesville, Ohio, are of equally importance. So they have not found New York, not Paris, Washington, London, etc. Or these towns have shifted in their importance. So either way, we either are told there is a shifting importance of towns, or this so-called intellectual antiquarian is a complete lunatic who's pumping up absolutely unimportant finds.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Or, third variation, we tend to overinterpret our findings and think they are important because we have found them and come to the conclusion, as we have found them, they must have been very, very important.
Yes.
And this only with a selection of few cities all over the world. I think it's marvelous.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marvelous trick from a writer to be able to give with a really a sleight of hand this many interpretations.
Yeah.
Because we are told by the narrator that these are intellectual, refined, civilized persons who only lack everyday ability. But I'm not quite sure whether their intellectual refinery is not also some kind of nincompoop artistry.
Yeah. Yeah, if you spend all your time thinking about banal things,
yeah,
you're just going to end up that way.
Well, you normally separate between an author and a narrator, the narrative voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not quite sure whether Vance hasn't done here the trick of giving us two narrators, one behind the other.
Mm.
Because there's sometimes you think it's told in everyday voice, how these people are, what they think, how they think. And then comes another voice telling us it cannot be true what you see. Something is very, very, very wrong. And it's also to be found in the narrative voice.
Yeah.
So two concurring or two antagonistic narrators.
That's interesting. Now I need to read it again with that in my mind and see what
and
I see.
And it leaves you baffled, you know? It's a story that leaves you very much baffled up to the end, which comes, as I think, a little bit abruptly.
Yeah, yeah. It does. The opening I was baffled by a little bit. And then when Zantin started to go through his motions, I felt like I had a good grasp of what was happening. And then you're right, the end came quickly. And then there was a lot of these philosophical discussions between him and, you know, people like Philidor about, you know, what they were doing, what their society was, how people should live.
Vance is giving here or telling here a cautionary tale, which is something you do not see all too often from him, at least not to my reading experience from Vance.
Yeah.
A society built on the blood and bones of other races, whatever the race, the word race means here, cannot stand.
Yeah.
It will have to fall.
Yeah.
And all the achievements, whether they are really beautiful or whether they are not beautiful, statues, art, or in this case here, some kind of textiles and what's it called? Essence, the things that they drink, all this has to fall.
Yeah, and I think that that is something that he touches on in most of what he writes when he's writing about the far future and what we know has not survived. That in itself is kind of a constant reminder that this stuff is ephemeral. It's not going to be forever.
Yeah, sure. You come back from Altair and you find Lübeck.
Mm-hmm.
Big deal.
Yeah, yeah. Right. And then, you know, like in things like the dying Earth. You know, he's writing about the far, far future, but, you know, everything that we know is distant myth. So it's similar.
So I think what we can agree upon is that it's a story about slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Or to put it more general, about exploitation.
Yeah.
You know, the Max could also stand in for the working classes in that aspect.
Yeah. Right.
People
and
you
could also say colonization.
Colonization. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So the, you know, these people have come back and then they just built these castles and said, you know, clearly we have the right to live here.
Sort of recolonization in a rather strange sense. And now we have to, I think we should look at the reaction of the different groups.
Okay.
Because that seems to me rather fruitful.
Mm-hmm.
We have, in general, we have three groups. The nomads who have been on the planet Earth before the aristocrats came back.
Yep.
And tried to live their life like indigenous people,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah, they live out in the world, out on the plains, out on wherever.
Yeah.
They're just living off the land. Yep.
Then the renegades. Who, in a form of back to the roots movement, if you like, or what I call the Amish reaction to something.
Yeah.
And the people who stay in their castles. And all three groups have one mistake, I think, in common. They ignore that the Mechs and the others are people as well.
Mm.
The nomads don't give a damn about that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The people from the castle are not interested in the well-being of their working force. But even the ones who say that they are looking for atonement, the expansionists, don't care about the Mac. They don't want to make their hands bloody or dirty or whatever, but they do not. They don't liberate.
I think I see what you're saying. So they feel guilty about it and therefore are don't want to participate in it, but they also don't want to lift a finger to fix it.
Absolutely.
Is that right? Okay, I'm with you.
Yeah, they take themselves out of the game.
Mm-hmm.
They think.
Yes.
But that's not completely true.
Mm-hmm.
You can see that guys like Philidor, who's one of the philosophical renegades, flees with them.
Mm-hmm.
He does not. And Vance's answer is, of course, rather problematic if you think about it.
Yeah.
He says, okay, so we have to unite to fight against the Mech and get them back out of our system.
Right. And so that's exactly, that is problematic because, you know, that's what I was mentioning earlier when they sent all the Mechs back.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't bode well. I mean, it's not a good solution. it's a problematic solution.
It might be. I think in the way he has it open in his story, you know, the ending is rushed. And he just satisfied with saying, okay, they want to go back, so we let them go back. We bring them even back.
If they want to go back, then yeah, that's a different story. But if you're expelling them, you know, and I know that that's it. When the Mechs actually, they're the ones who had the terms.
We have to be precise here. They come back after they lose. They win the war against the castle, and they get stuck in the castle, and they are surrounded and starved out. They cannot hope to hold out. We need only destroy the sun cells, and they can't synthesize.
That's
no
exactly cyber. Right. So they take over the castle Hagadorn, but then they lose the war because they're starved out.
That's right. Signaled, "Men, we starve. We have maintained your treasures. Give us our lives or we destroy all before we die."
Right, right.
And that's an interesting thing. They threat to destroy all the stuff inside the castle before they die.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a threat, or that's the stake they put into the game to get out of it.
So, right, that's intensely problematic. Looking at the history of humanity, I mean, they could have eliminated them, and that would be horrible. But to send them away, you know, saying we can't live with you is also problematic.
And I will not hold it against Vance, and I won't put the allegorical side too high. Uh-huh. It's not a one-on-one narration, but
yes.
There is something like a moral and a narrative problem. And I will not say he copped out, but he stopped before things got too complicated for him to handle.
Yeah.
Maybe. And I think for 1966, it's I wouldn't say it's legit,
mm-hmm.
but it's an understandable reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
So the Mech Lives Matter story is here in the end solved in a rather problematic way. And we do not get any information about the other creatures.
Right.
By the way.
Right. Yeah.
Which is also quite strange.
Yeah. So I see what you're saying now about it being rushed. I mean, not only in plot, but also because there's these threads that are, because what about the Fanes? What about all these other things that they pulled in? The birds, the Fanes, the peasants, all these other alien races that they've brought in.
Return to sender, address unknown?
Yeah. I don't know. It's like, you know, how do you roll that back? You know, it's such a hard thing, you know, for our time right now. How do you roll that back? How do you get to a place where we're getting along?
And I think 50 years ago, this could be explained away, but that it doesn't lessen the story. Don't get me wrong. It's a story of its time and in its time, and it's rather prescient, and it's a wonderfully written story, except for the rush in the end. But some stuff, and it's a pity that Jack Vance is dead. I would have loved to ask him whether he, with the hindsight of 30, 40 years, he died two or three years ago, I guess, what he would have to say to that.
Yeah, we have the afterword in the Jack Vance Treasury.
Yeah, that's from 1976. I wanted to get to that also because there's a wonderful hint.
Okay, shall I read it? It's not very long.
Yeah, read it, please.
Okay, so here's Jack Vance's afterword to The Last Castle contained in the Jack Vance Treasury. He wrote this in 1976. Sometimes the source of a story is a mystery even to the writer himself. a sea page from his subconscious. Other times, the derivation is clear and direct. In the case of The Last Castle, both situations are equally true. The germ of the story was contained in an article dealing with Japanese social interactions. As is well known, the Japanese society is highly formalized, much more thoroughly so in the past than during relatively egalitarian times since the last war. During the 19th century, when a samurai deigned to converse with a person of lower rank, each used markedly different vocabularies, which honorifics precisely calculated to the difference in status. When the person of lower degree discussed the samurai's activities or intentions, he used a special convention. Never would he pose a simple question such as, "Will your lordship go boat hunting or boar hunting tomorrow?" This would impute to his lordship a coarse and undignified fervor, a sweating, earnest, lip-licking zeal, which his lordship would have found offensively below his dignity. Instead, the underling might ask, "Will your lordship tomorrow amuse himself by trifling at the hunting of a boar?" In short, the aristocrat was conceited sensibilities of such exquisite nicety, competences of such awful grandeur, that he need only toy with all ordinary activities in a mood of whimsy or caprice in order to achieve dazzling successes. So, The Last Castle concerns a society of somewhat similar folk and examines their behavior when the society is subjected to great stress. And that is what he said.
And that is what he said.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm waiting for the second shoe to drop. Where is the seepage from the unconscious?
I don't know. Yeah, he said it's here and he said, yeah, it comes from both places and then described one of the places. Yep.
And end of story.
End of story.
Isn't that wonderfully interesting?
Mm-hmm. It is.
Isn't that fine?
Mm-hmm.
All the stuff that might have subconsciously or half-consciously gotten into the story is hinted at, but in no way explained.
Yeah.
And this is 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is too much of a coincidence for me.
Very interesting.
And 76 was something else entirely than 1966.
Yeah, I mean, it says so much, and it's incredibly pertinent to our times right now. You know, there's a lot of things that it's saying. But the Japanese thing, I mean, that's interesting. You know, so this idea that the aristocrats are separating themselves from the rest of humanity is something that's happened in the past and is happening now, will happen in the future. You know, the whole just, you know, we call them aristocrats or rich folks. You know, there's a distance between them that is getting larger between them and the rest of the population, you know. And I know that's happening in the United States. I don't know if it's happening in Europe as well.
Sure. Linguistically, it's still true what he says. I've studied together with a few people from Korea and Thailand, and they have still the system of honorifics, 11 or 12 forms of saying I and you, for example, depending on the social situation.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And in so far, his allusion to Asian culture, to Japanese culture, is perfectly legit, but the subconscious he's working with, the race struggle in the U.S.,
mm-hmm.
the struggles in capitalism between the employer and the employees, for example, everything is to be found in the story, and he doesn't even mention it in the afterword 10 years later by talking about his subconscious seeping in and seeping out. Oh, come on. Really.
So do you think that rather than, what am I trying to say here? Rather than confront what he had opened, he just ended the story?
Maybe so.
So you're saying, you know, to me, you know, at the beginning, it was like maybe he was trying to hit a certain length for sales or something like that, and then said, oh, I've got to do this, but I'm not going to be able to close all these open ends. But instead, it's almost as if he doesn't want to confront the subconscious stuff, not even in his afterword. He just wants to stop.
Well, I think there are two major directions this argument could go. Mm. On the one hand, he didn't dare to stand to his own idea. Maybe so.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, as we are able to talk about the story 50 years later and it's still working in us and around us, it might be a device of an author who doesn't give away too much. Make you up your own mind. I think a writer of his capacity offering in an afterword two ways and then giving only one away, the less complicated one, the historical illusion.
Yeah.
Hmm. Maybe it's a time bomb. I think the story is really, really up to, also apart from some stuff like the women, the role of the one woman that's mentioned here, and the, we call it nymphs, what do we call the fanes?
The fanes, yeah.
Yeah. This is really old-fashioned and a little bit long in the tooth. But the other stuff, the political stuff, I think is still top-notch. And that's another historical illusion. Have you ever seen Gone with the Wind?
I have not. That's a gap I need to take care of, but no, I haven't.
Oh, what a pity. There is a particular scene at a party, and I've seen it 20 years ago or so, and there is Red Butler at the party, the ambivalent. I have completely forgotten where the party was. It's one of the parties in the Deep South, and along comes a young man, says, hooray, hooray, war has started. Finally, we'll fight against the North, UPID. Everybody is really, really happy. And Red Butler says, we're going to lose the war. Oh, no, you're a coward. Mr. Butler, you're a coward and a scoundrel, etc., etc. And he says, the North has the factories, he has the guns, yeah, the North has the people, and they will win in the end. And the reaction to this is absolutely identical to the reaction of the aristocrats of Castle Hagedorn, unable to see what's coming to them, unwilling to understand it. And for our listeners who have seen Gone with the Wind, the reaction and the resignation of the Hagedorn is reminiscent, I think, of the resignation of Ashley Wilkes of 12 Oaks.
Very interesting. Yep.
Unable to accept that the old South will not be any more.
Right, right.
The South will not rise again. And Castle Hagedorn will not rise again. And you can turn it like Richmond into a museum, but Richmond will never be the capital of the United States again, of the Confederate States. At least not as much as we know, because some people think they can turn the clock back. But it's not in the nature of clocks to be turned back. Decline comes in many forms and shapes. What I think is, of course, a peril, that's the denial to the last moment that things are falling apart.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that everyone who hints we can't do that any longer or this is going to blow apart is considered to be an outsider of the aristocratic society.
You bet. And I really just love his style. I love the landscape. Yeah. It feels like a beautiful desolation. I really enjoy his writing. And it is here. This is one of his best works, I think.
I think so, too.
Yeah, so it's definitely worth rereading and taking a look at and letting the philosophy in there, you know, spur your thought, you know, agree or disagree.
Yeah,
It's all very worthwhile.
We might not like his answers or the lack of answers, but the question he gives us, the questions are still really, really important. And I don't know whether you watch a lot of Doctor Who in the United States.
People do, but I have not.
Okay, yeah. There is the time machine looking like a police box, you know, the TARDIS.
Yeah. Right, the TARDIS,
the TARDIS, as the English And they all say, it's bigger on the inside. And I think we can say that about that story. It's bigger on the inside.
Agreed. Very well put. Very well put. And thank you for selecting this. It's been a fascinating conversation. Fascinating that and meaningful, was. Right? So, yeah. All right, so next up for us is Cassandra by C.J. Cherry.
Yeah. Looking forward to that, quite a short story.
Yeah.
Because, you know, our motto was it's to be read a single sitting, the Jack Vance story was a rather long sitting.
A little bit anyway. Of a long sitting, about 100 pager, you bet. Well, thanks for joining us, everybody. Thank you.